welcome. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. During his visit to San Francisco yesterday, President Obama made the case for immigration reform on a moral basis and an economic one.
Independent economists have shown that if the Senate bill became law over the next two decades, our economy would grow by $1.4 trillion more than it would if we don't pass the law. It would reduce our deficits by nearly $1 trillion. So this isn't just the right thing to do, it's the smart thing to do.
Part of the economic case for immigration reform is that by bringing undocumented immigrants into the legal workforce, both wages and government revenues will increase. But there is a broader assumption underlying this as well. When you have a more diverse pool of talent to draw from, the result is a more dynamic economy. When men and women of all races and national backgrounds have the opportunity to freely pursue work opportunities, and when those individuals have the chance to work together, they compare perspectives, identify new approaches to problems, and innovate in ways that benefit the economy as a whole. Now, in different forms, that basic narrative, diversity as a driver of economic growth, is employed by politicians and activists on the left and the right. In many ways, it's become part of the mythology used to explain the rise of the growth of the United States into the world's largest economy. And it's also an assumption that economists are actively engaged in testing. And on today's Your Call, as part of our continuing Agenda for a New Economy series, we're going to talk with two big thinkers about the relationship between a diverse society and a productive economy. Joining us first is Oded Galor. He's professor of economics at Brown University, editor of the Journal of Economic Growth, and he's author of the book Unified Growth Theory, which investigates the entire growth process from the dawn of civilization up to the present, and he joins us from Providence, Rhode Island. Professor Galor, great to have you with us.
I am happy to be with you.
And a bit closer to home, we are joined by from Santa Clara by Alexander Field. He's professor of economics at Santa Clara University, and he's the author of A Great Leap Forward, and that's an investigation of how the Great Depression actually set the stage for the post-World War II boom in the United States. Professor Field, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much. I'm very happy to be here as well.
Great to have you with us. I think it's going to be a really wide-ranging conversation. And Professor Field, I want to start with you. What kind of sparked our discussion about this is we've been talking about having a program talking about economic productivity and what drives it and how it's measured. And in looking at that, we came in over a study that was done a couple of years ago, a working paper, in which a set of economists looked at the effect of the entrance of women and African Americans into the workforce over the last 50 years, how that's affected overall economic activity. These economists, there were preliminary findings, but they said, we think that as much as 20% of the productivity growth over that time may have been driven by those new talents, new people with their ideas and perspectives coming into the workforce. You're someone who's looked at the United States economy as an economic historian over a long period of time and looked at the Depression and how it set the stage for growth after World War II. I guess two questions I have for you. One, when it comes to trying to answer a question like that, how does a diverse workforce affect overall economic productivity? First, how do economists even go at a question like that?
Well, I think the argument is certainly plausible, because if you have institutional or legal restrictions on the full employment or the full exploitation of the talents of various groups, whether they be African Americans or women or gays or whatever, then you're depriving of the economy of a boost to productivity that otherwise could enjoy. So I think that's the way that economists would approach this.
So that's the hypothesis. How do you go about actually testing something like that? What kind of data do we have to work with? How would you if you were working with some graduate students thinking about how we'd actually investigate this, what might you do?
Well, I guess you try to, correlation is not going to be causation, but you would try to look at the increased entry of women and other groups into the labor force and see if it seemed to be associated with an increase in output per hour, and you try to look at this, since economics is a non-experimental science, you try to compare different periods and try to draw some inferences from that.
And when you think, one thing that you have focused on in your work is the role of technology and technological change in economic growth over the same period that we're talking about here. How would you try to distinguish what might be the impacts of something like technological change from this change in the composition in the workforce?
Well, that's going to be difficult to some certainly, but we can decompose certainly the growth of the labor force into its different components, and the crudest way of trying to measure the impact of technological and organizational change is what's left over in terms of accounting for economic growth after you've explored the contributions of the labor force conventionally measured as well as the physical capital stock. So you would try to essentially adjust the labor input to take account of the increased participation of these groups, and then again the residual or whatever would be what you would at least start with in terms of attributing to technological and organizational innovation.
So Professor Galore, I want to bring you into this. You in your work have taken on an even more kind of awesome thing to understand, and that is really we're talking about millennia of economic growth and what the impact of kind of diverse societies, people crossing paths with one another, have had on that kind of development. How did you start doing that kind of investigation?
Okay, so
Professor Galore?
Yes, please. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead. You're on the air. We had a little momentary problem there, but you're go ahead.
Yeah, so the starting point of my research on the subject was an attempt to understand why some countries are so rich and others are so poor, and somehow to try to trace it into some initial conditions that existed long ago. And initially, we thought about different type of initial conditions, and naturally, ultimately, it led us into the origins of mankind in Africa long ago, nearly 100,000 years ago, the exodus of modern humans from Africa long ago, and its effect on the distribution of initially genetic diversity and ultimately the overall level of diversity across societies. So in some sense, we wanted to understand the disparity in income per capita across the globe, but at the same time, we wanted to have a better understanding of how diversity affects economic development. Now, the starting point was the understanding that, in fact, diversity should be associated with some costs and some benefits. On the one hand, on the cost side, one should expect diverse society to be less trustful, less cohesive, less coordinated, and as a result of it, to operate within its production capabilities. But on the other hand, it was apparent to us that more diverse society would have complementary traits that can ultimately benefit the society in terms of productivity, innovations, and consequently the position of the economy relative to other societies in the production possibility frontier.
So if you're looking far back in history and you say you have these two ideas of what the potential impact of a more diverse society would be on the economy, how did you actually try to get at those questions of how, you know, whether it was more of a cost or more of a benefit?
So, I mean, so part of the difficulty, broadly speaking, and I'm taking it a step backward, is to understand what is the relationship between diversity and development, and if possible, what is the causation from diversity to economic growth. And in order to tease out this issue of diversity, we wanted to take, in some sense, a measure of diversity that cannot be affected by contemporary economic outcomes. So consequently, we focus on the out-of-Africa hypothesis and its effect on genetic diversity. And through genetic diversity, we reach a proxy for the level of diversity as we see it in today's world. Now, what we were able to show in the context of this research is that, indeed, genetic diversity has some costs and some benefits, in the sense that we show that societies that tend to be more diverse genetically tend to be less trustful on average, tend to fight more in the context of civil conflicts. But on the other hand, the same societies that tend to be more diverse, are those societies that will be on average more innovative. And consequently, we ask ourselves, is there an optimal level of diversity? Is there an optimal mixture of different type of traits that will benefit societies? And what we try to understand is how, in fact, first, how can one establish this level of the optimal level of diversity? And second, how this optimal level of diversity change in the process of development? So what we establish is that, in fact, if you view the world, say, in the year 1500, 500 years ago, it appears that the optimally diverse society at the time was the Japanese society, or societies in the Far East. But as we moved into the present, in fact, the optimally diverse society at the present is the American society. And this was reassuring in many dimensions. First, it was reassuring because it appears that somehow diversity is indeed conducive for economic development, and it appears, as I said, that the right mixture in terms of complementary traits appears in the United States.
So, Professor Galore, I want to follow up on that, particularly kind of asking the question of whether what element is about a diverse society and what is about equality of opportunity that allows diverse groups, individuals in a society to actually participate in what that means for growth. But I want to invite listeners to join the conversation. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar on today's Your Call. And we are talking about the relationship between a diverse economy, a diverse workforce in society, and economic growth and economic dynamism. President Obama was in town yesterday pushing his immigration proposal, and one of the arguments he made is that by having diverse talents coming into this country and having a place where they can work and express themselves, that's going to make for a more productive economy. We invite you to join the conversation at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. We've just been hearing from Professor Galore, who looks at these issues really over millennia. We're also talking to Professor Alexander Field, who is a professor of economics at Santa Clara University, who's really focused on the United States in the past century. We want to hear what your experience has been seeing a changing workforce, talking about how diversity actually expresses itself in a specific business or a specific workplace. 866-798-8255. We welcome your questions and experiences. And I guess, Professor Galore, I want to go back to you and then hear from Professor Field. You're saying that you've kind of found that there's something really, I mean, that maybe if that optimal mix may be happening in the United States in the current period. But is it about the mix of people? Because you're looking in the past, you're saying, okay, just here's the genetic diversity. But a big change that's happened in the United States is not just who's here. It's about who's allowed to participate and on what basis. And that's, I think, what some of this research about diversity in the workforce and opportunity there and its impact on economic growth has shown, that that's really important, that they be able to be part of the workforce.
Indeed. So when we think about this trade-off between the costs and the benefits of diversity, then naturally one can affect this trade-off. And part of the costs that are associated with diversity, as I said before, has to do with lack of trust, incohesiveness of society, discoordination of society. And these elements can be overcome by proper education methods that will ultimately allow individuals to cope better, to respect one another, and to cooperate better. In particular, in society in which mobility is restricted, then in fact the cost of diversity will be overwhelming, but the benefits of diversity will not be there. So the work that you cited earlier by several economists that show that in fact the integration of African Americans and women into the American labor force is associated with an increase of about 20% in productivity, is in fact one of the forces that we have in mind when we think about the trade-off between the cost and the benefit of diversity. Because the cost is there, and we can mitigate the cost, as I said before, by educating the society to respect one another. But in addition, in order to benefit from this diversity, we have to allow the society to be mobile. We have to allow individuals to be placed according to their talents rather than according to their initial conditions.
So, Professor Field, you're a historian of the U.S. economy.
Uh-huh.
When you're talking about these changes that have taken place that we're talking about here in terms of how people have been able to participate in the workforce and who's been able to participate equally, and Professor Galore's hypothesis that the United States may be reaching some kind of optimal mix of that balance between diversity and cohesion and what it does for the economy. What would you add to that that gets more specific about the American example?
Well, I think the two sometimes opposing forces that Professor Galore has identified in terms of the greater potential for conflict, that can be a negative, and also the benefits from cooperation and full exploitation of different ideas and innovation are, of course, applicable to the United States. I mean, the fact that the productivity will go up if we give people, we don't have legal or other restrictions in terms of their entry into the labor force is definitely the case, but it's also the case that doesn't necessarily mean it happens that way. I mean, the United States fought a bloody civil war over the issue of citizenship for African Americans and freedom for African Americans. 600,000 people dead, over 600,000 people dead in a population of 31 million. You know, after the fact, the federal government could have purchased every single slave at current market prices and given every freedman, you know, 40 acres and a mule for less than the cost of the war. So it doesn't necessarily happen. And so I wanted to add that to my point. The study that we're talking about is studying the effect of continued progress in breaking down barriers in terms of the full participation of different groups in the U.S. economy.
And I definitely want to get to talking about, I mean, that struggle is definitely not over. And given that new people will continue to come to the country, the question of how they're brought into the economy on an equal basis, something we have to kind of confront as a country. So we're definitely
absolutely
going to do that. That's Professor Alexander Field of Santa Clara University. Also with us is Oded Galor, Professor of Economics at Brown University. And we've got a couple of folks on the line who want to join the conversation. Ben in Santa Cruz. Ben, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Hey, thanks. I just have a general question, maybe for both of these professors. If you've seen any connection between the health of, say, an ecosystem because of biodiversity, ecological biodiversity, and if there's anyone or taking an approach to extrapolate that to having a healthy economy.
Thanks, Ben. Professor Galor, have you seen any research that's talking about the biodiversity and its connection to these questions? Taking it to an even broader level, but I thought you might have some insights.
Well, that's. I don't think that I'm aware of research that is linking directly these two issues. Naturally, biodiversity is associated with diversity as a whole. So, if we want to trace the origin of diversity across humans, then naturally, it will have some association with biodiversity, but. I'm not sufficiently familiar with research on the intersection between biodiversity and economic diversity.
Well, I guess, I mean, if you're talking about genetic diversity in human beings, that itself is a form of biodiversity. But
indeed,
maybe
indeed.
Ben is certainly talking about an area that hasn't been investigated as much, at least by economists you're familiar with. Let's go next to Eid in Berkeley, who wanted to join the conversation. Eid, welcome to your call.
Good morning. I totally disagree with Obama. I disagree a lot with both of your guests, because we have a lot of talent here. A lot of these people, so-called talent from abroad, they already have their education in the United States and go back home and come back. The whole idea was Milton Friedman and the rest of the new liberals that have totally destroyed the U.S. economy by all of this voodoo economics based on bringing talent, closing factories, sending factories overseas to China and Korea and so on, and what nicely called outsourcing job was really just exporting jobs overseas. The United States is in bad shape, the whole world in bad shape, because of the action of few people, new liberals, and Milton Friedman is their head, Greenspan, and the rest of them. But just let me finish for 1 second.
Please.
I am really disappointed at all of the economists at UC Berkeley and at other schools. The only two impressed me a lot is Paul Krugman and Robert Reich in our University of California, Berkeley. This is the only people who know what is going on. Fair trade was never fair. Free trade was never free. NAFTA and CAFTA was nothing but a shafter to the American people and people of Mexico.
I want to get us back to our conversation, which you actually make a really important point about, complicating what diversity means and what it says we want to try to have a more diverse participation in the workforce. I mean, I started this out by talking about President Obama and his speech about immigration reform and making an economic case for that. But there certainly is a case to be made that people who already live in a very diverse United States could be impacted in some different ways, not all of them positive, by new people coming into the workforce. Alexander Field, take that where you'd like to, but I'd just be interested in your thoughts.
Well, I mean, I don't think there's any question that there's been a very sharp increase in income inequality over the last 30 years and also of wealth inequality. There's a big debate about the degree to which that is associated with globalization and how much of it's is to be attributed to that. My own feeling is that various institutional factors, including the explosion of CEO pay, which I think has been encouraged by the drops in marginal tax rates, as well as the growth of the finance sector, which in 2003 managed to generate 40% of all domestic corporate profits. Those have also been contributors. But I think the globalization issue is a contributor there. But it's really, I think, as you were trying to suggest, Matt, it's a somewhat separate issue to the question of how we treat people within the United States and how we try to take full advantage of what they might be able to contribute to the national economy.
But I guess the question is, I mean, one thing that came out of this research that we talked about the entrance of women and African Americans into the workforce, they saw their wages increase greatly. As a result, the aggregate economic activity of the country and our productivity increased because of their participation. But there were losers in that process, and specifically white men actually saw their wages decline over that time. And so I guess that kind of question of like what it means when we say we value diversity and that will have an aggregate positive economic effect. I mean, how would you approach that, you know, thinking about that from an economist's
perspective? Well, in terms of thinking about these kind of economics and welfare economics, economists have traditionally kind of tried to move away from making comparisons of welfare between individuals. What they really love are what are called Pareto improving changes. Those are changes which make somebody better off without making somebody else worse off, or if they make somebody better off, at least there's enough that you can kind of pay off or, you know, buy off the people who are losers. Just getting back in terms of the point about trust and conflict, because some institutional or cultural or normative change is in the benefit of the economy as a whole, does not necessarily or automatically mean that it happens. And again, you know, I did make reference to the history of the United States, the fact that slavery was enshrined, although it wasn't mentioned by name in the U.S. Constitution, and it took a bloody civil war to end that.
That is Professor Alexander Field. He is teaches economics at Santa Clara University. He's the author of A Great Leap Forward, which is about how the Great Depression set the stage for U.S. economic growth following World War II. Also with us is Professor Oded Galor, who is from Brown University, and his book is Unified Growth Theory, which investigates the entire growth process from the dawn of civilization today. We're about to go to a break, but Professor Galor, I wanted very briefly to get you to respond. This question of economic inequality, I think we talk about genetic diversity, gender diversity, but the very fact that you could have people in very different classes and decreasing mobility between those classes, how could that impact overall growth of the ability to have a dynamic economy?
Well, I think that we should note that if we have a more diverse society, this diversity will be reflected by different types of characteristics, and consequently we should expect in a more diverse society to find more inequality. We have a more diverse society in many different dimensions. We must have a more diverse society in terms of cognitive abilities, more diverse society in terms of physical abilities, and consequently, a more diverse society in terms of productive traits. And this will result ultimately in more inequality in the labor market. And this is, in some sense, an inevitable trade-off in this context. Yes, we can gain in terms of productivity by having complementary traits. Yes, we can benefit in terms of productivity.
Professor Galor, hold that thought one moment. We're going to be right back. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call.
We invite you to join us in today's conversation. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to the program, call 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. Or you can send your question or comment via email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be right back.
For those of you just joining us, I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. You can always find more information about the show at yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can listen to past shows and share programs that you value that we have broadcast. Tomorrow, we're going to be having a conversation about what we can learn about our changing economy in Northern California from people who are homeless. We're going to talk to them about the impact of the tech boom on their lives and try to create a dialogue between people who are living on the streets and those of us who might just pass them as we go to work or school or about our daily business. And on Thursday, we're going to rebroadcast a conversation that Rose Aguilar had with Lori Silverbush, co-director of A Place at the Table, a new documentary about the United States' growing hunger epidemic. So that's coming up on Thursday on Your Call. Today, we're talking about the relationship between a diverse society and a dynamic economy. And with us for this conversation this hour are Oded Galor. He is professor of economics at Brown University and editor of the Journal of Economic Growth. And he's also author of Unified Growth Theory, which investigates the entire growth process from the dawn of civilization to the current day. And a little closer to home, we're joined by Alexander Field. He's a professor of economics at Santa Clara University and author of A Great Leap Forward, which is about how the Great Depression set the stage for the post-World War II boom in the United States. We also welcome your calls and questions at 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. What do you see in your experience or what you've known in your lifetime? How has a changing workforce, a more diverse workforce, has it created economic activity? Have you seen places where it's created new ventures or innovation? Or have you seen places where there's that kind of friction that Professor Galor talks about that may actually make it more difficult to run a business or to have have economic activity be stronger? We're talking about that balance. We're talking about what the optimum is and getting also to the question of, as a nation and as communities, how should we promote diversity in a way that supports economic activity? The number to call once again is 866-798-8255. I actually want to go next to Matt in Oakland, who is on the line. Matt, welcome to Your Call. Good to have you with us. What's your question or comment?
Thank you very much. My question was whether there have been other places or times in history where these kinds of this level of diversity has occurred, and what did that mean for those particular societies? It seems to me that when you have a group, when people are prized for their ideas and their abilities rather than for their lineage or their racial background, that it would kind of create this assemblage of talent that it almost seems to follow this would happen. I know there's been research that was done with a specific research building at MIT, how Steve Jobs apparently designed the Pixar campus so that people from different disciplines are compelled to interact with one another, and those have been particularly fruitful. Is that what we're seeing, but on a societal level?
Matt, great question, and I'm going to turn that to Professor Galor. I mean, looking back in history, are there some other high points or specific places you say, like, oh, here's a real example of where the diversity was really feeding economic innovation and growth?
I suppose that a large number of historical examples, particularly in the context of Europe, in which the introduction of certain minority groups into society benefited in terms of innovations and in terms of productivity. As I said earlier, if we simply think about the degree of diversity that was optimal in the past, it appears that it was much lower than in today's world. And this is partly due to the fact that in the past, innovations were less important than cohesiveness. So in the context of this trade-off between innovations and cohesiveness, it appears that in the past, societies that were relatively less diverse, more homogeneous, benefited more because cohesiveness was so important. But as we move into the 21st century, and as we move into a society in which innovations are so important and the technological landscape is changing more rapidly, then naturally the virtues of diversity are compensating for the non-cohesiveness that is associated with diversity, and consequently we see that societies like the United States is the one that is dominating the scene. But historically we do see that in fact societies that integrated minorities benefited from these minorities, and there are plenty of examples. about it in the context, in the European context, particularly the integration of segments of the Jewish population into the Ottoman Empire, into the and into other societies, was quite critical in their technological evolution over this time period.
Professor Field, you were raising some specific examples from the American past, where obviously the ongoing exclusion of certain groups from the economy, from equal citizenship. You want to remind people this is not, this has been a long struggle in that. But are there some examples of where you see, Professor Galore talks about some European examples, but in the United States context, where it's clear that having a diverse workforce or a more open workforce really, really drove growth and innovation?
Well, let me just also just add to the European case. I mean, not, obviously the case of Jewish populations is relevant here, but we can also point to a society such as Switzerland, which, supports four different languages as one which has managed to deal with the problem of conflict relatively well and also experiencing strong economic growth over the last couple of centuries. I mean, as I've been listening to Professor Galore, I'm struck by the importance of distinguishing between the question of whether a society has a diverse, a diverse population, however you want to measure genetic diversity, variants of different ethnic groups, and the question of the degree to which the institutional, normative, and legal structure allows those individuals to reach their full potential and contribute to the economy. And I think that's related to the question of the degree to which we have, conflict or not. I also just wanted to go back to an earlier point that Professor Galore made, and it had to do about the relationship between greater diversity and more inequality. I think there was a suggestion that perhaps integrating more diverse groups into the economy would necessarily lead to more inequality. I don't know if that was what was proposed, but I think if you want to look at U.S. economic history, certainly the abolition of slavery and the reductions of barriers to the entry of African Americans and others has reduced inequality of income between those groups, and I would suggest probably reduced, had some effect on, moderating overall measures of inequality in the economy.
Thank you so much. I want to hear from William in Belvedere. William, welcome to your call.
Yes, thank you. This is a wide-ranging discussion, and I hope you will consider this to be within the purview of the subject.
Go for it.
Many people who feel that we should encourage diversity deal with the issue of people who are here currently without documents and say that there should be no deportations of those people, that they should remain and become full citizens in our society. The natural going forward of that concept of increasing diversity in that way would be to open the borders, because then you would really get a lot of people coming in. I'd appreciate either of the guests or both commenting on how they feel about that, what would seem to be logical step if one feels that encouraging diversity is an extremely important thing.
Seems like a relevant question, William. Professor Field, maybe you could start. Professor Galore, and be brief. We've got a lot of folks who want to join the conversation.
Yeah, I think that's a very, complicated question. I don't know that I have a fully worked out position on it, but I think it is also worth mentioning. I mean, of course, the United States did basically have unrestricted immigration, provided you weren't an anarchist and didn't have tuberculosis up through the First World War. I think it's also worth mentioning that the economy does benefit from immigration, because generally people come in as adults. They've already been raised to the years when they can enter the labor force, and often they do bring in education. But I think it's an extremely complicated question and an important question for the listener to raise.
Professor Galore?
I agree that it's very complex, and I think that when I'm referring to the benefits of diversity, I'm referring to long-run benefits. And I think that when we think about immigration and its impact on diversity, probably the initial impact of immigration is associated with the difficulties in absorbing immigrants and assuring the cohesiveness of the society, and the benefits will come with some delay. So in this respect, my viewpoint in the context of how immigration is benefiting the economy in the short run, in the context of diversity, is less than clear. It's clear that in the long run, immigration can benefit the society, but certainly there could be short-run losses that we should be aware of.
Well, let's talk for a minute about it. We have a comment at KALW.org where people can leave comments. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. One listener wants to bring diversity of another dimension into the conversation, saying when people talk about diversity, they rarely mean age diversity. And yet, because of age discrimination, an important segment of our society is cut off from participation. The aging population has the judgment and perspective our economy needs. And Professor Field, I definitely, I think about here in the Bay Area where technology, we have this very youth-driven kind of industry that seems to discount people who might be above a certain age and the value that they have to contribute. I mean, how might you think about that and put that in some perspective historically?
Well, I think the evidence is that, wisdom and experience matter. And, there is also, I think, a certain slowing down and there may be some reductions in the degree of how hungry people are as they get older, depending on how well they've done. But I certainly the problem of age discrimination is a very real one. I think everything would be helped in terms of various groups who've had trouble participating fully in the current economy if we had had, frankly, a larger American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, and if we had sufficient aggregate demand to bring the economy closer to potential or full employment output. We're still operating 6 or 7% below capacity, and that means people out of work.
That's Professor Alexander Field, Professor of Economics at Santa Clara University. Also with us on today's Your Call is Oded Galor, who's a professor at Brown University and editor of the Journal of Economic Growth. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and we are having a wide-ranging conversation about the relationship between a diverse workforce, a diverse society, and economic dynamism. And we welcome you to join the program. We're having folks weigh in a lot of different elements of diversity and what it means for our economy. You're welcome to join the conversation. We have about 10 minutes left at 866-798-8255. Is there an economic case for a more diverse, open workforce? Have you seen that in action? And hey, here in the 21st century United States, what does diversity mean? What are the most important elements of it to talk about? And if it is economically valuable, how do you think we make it a reality, whether it's in a workplace, in a city, in an industry, or in this country as a whole? 866-798-8255. I want to go to Rebecca in Corte Madera. Rebecca, thanks for holding on and welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. One of the sort of quote benefits of diversity that America has benefited from is during times of slavery, of course, all that free labor. And now so many minorities taking these, super, super low paying jobs. Jobs that they can't make a living income doing, and when some of the arguments I hear for open immigration is, well, we can get more of these workers who are willing to really work for almost nothing, and that is sort of what the American economy has been structured on. So I'm not sure that it's the diversity itself, We're not really getting the creativity of these people. For the most part, we're just getting the cheap labor.
That's a great point, Rebecca. Let's I want to hear what Professor Field might have to offer about that.
Well, I think immigration to the United States, certainly legal immigration, has been bimodal in the sense that you've had a bunch of very highly educated individuals from countries like India and elsewhere, and frankly, that's been a brain drain for those countries. The United States economy has benefited tremendously from the initiative and creativity and ideas that they've brought in. I mean, that's a separate issue from our problem right now in terms of operating the economy below capacity and the involuntary unemployment that means for our economy as a whole. In terms of their ability to contribute and have high productivity, I mean, the diversity in the population may have a beneficial overall effect, but it's still going to be the case that a more highly trained, more highly educated, more experienced worker is likely to be more productive. So in terms of what the short-run benefit, as Professor Galore was talking about, of immigration means for the economy, the composition of the immigration makes a big difference.
I guess I want to turn the question to Professor Galore, and you're talking about in a more diverse society, there's kind of more social distance between different groups. They might have less trust and understanding of one another. I mean, is the fact if you have waves of immigration, does it make exploitation more possible, at least in the kind of short run?
I suppose that exploitations are unlikely, even in the short run. I think that naturally part of what was discussed earlier is this new waves of immigrants are likely to be underpaid, but I wouldn't call it exploitation. It will simply reflect their a position in the labor market, their lack of specific human capital for the American labor market. But ultimately, I think that specific human capital is gain, and consequently, I would expect people to be paid properly.
But if you have a situation like we have in the United States now, where we have more than 10 million people who are here working who don't have legal status, that makes it difficult for them to achieve what you're talking about, right?
Of course, if you refer to illegal immigrants, the situation is much more complex because indeed, I mean, given the fact that they do not have the proper legal documents that permit them to enter into the labor market and to compete fairly, then they can be subjected to exploitation. But if we ignore illegal immigrants, then as I said, I think that over time this issue should dissipate in the sense that people do gain specific human capital for the American labor market. Consequently, I would expect this phenomena that you defined as exploitation to dissipate over time.
The number to join our conversation is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. I want to go to Art right now, who's called in from El Cerrito. Welcome, Art.
Hi. Hello. It's clear to me how cultural diversity is important, and it's clear how cognitive diversity is important. It's not yet clear to me how they're correlated. I've tried to see how gender diversity, cultural diversity, ethnic diversity would play a role in approaching problems at my own work, and it's really not clear. People, it's cognitive diversity that makes a difference, but I'm not sure that there's any correlation with cultural diversity. I'm wondering if there's any research that indicates that there is a correlation.
So what you're saying, Art, is that there's some difference in terms of ways people think that might not show up on a census form, but would be important to contributing to a more effective workplace or innovation, that kind of thing. Either Professor Field, Professor Glore, have any thoughts about that?
Well, I think the issues that are being raised are, again, the two sometimes opposing forces that Professor Glore emphasized. There are obviously challenges in integrating people who come from different cultural backgrounds into a workforce and helping them work together as a productive team. I think one organization in this country that has had a long history and, in fact, very considerable success in this regard is the United States Army. Which, of course, has been quite successful in taking advantage of the capabilities that African Americans and increasingly women and increasingly gay men and women have been able to bring to that organization.
Actually, a question that I have just specifically related to the Army, and in my mind, maybe it also connects to the tech field, for instance, where people from different nationalities are coming together and working on projects together. There's a really strong kind of unifying culture in those industries or in the military that in some ways, I mean, you may say it erases, you might just say it unifies beyond some of those other dimensions.
Yeah, but the unifying culture you talk about in the military was created
there, but
with great angst and with great struggle. It was not a simple fashion, and there were lots of people who resisted this very strongly. All right. Of these integrations.
Great. Professor Glore, anything to add?
Well, there was a question whether, in fact, research is showing that cultural diversity is beneficial. At least part of my research on the subject showed that if, in fact, you measure properly cultural diversity within contemporary advanced economies, it does appear to be the case that cultural diversity is contributing to economic development overall. And this is naturally conditional on the fact that the education system is in place and the education system is mitigating potential social tensions and mitigating potential issues of non-cohesiveness. So that's the reason that I qualify the statement that this is irregularity that we see in the data for contemporary advanced economies, economies that invest sufficiently in education so as to assure that the society is relatively cohesive.
I just want to follow up on Art's question. He was saying, you know, there's this difference between cultural or ethnic or gender diversity and, say, cognitive diversity, ways of approaching problems or thinking about things. Do you see that kind of being similar to cultural diversity, or there might be a different set of questions asked there?
It's complex, and it's not very clear how to measure these issues properly, but certainly, again, in my research, I can see the distinction between cultural diversity and genetic diversity, and I can see both of them operating not independently, but each of them is contributing to economic development. So I suppose that it goes beyond the diversity in cognitive traits. It's really capturing other elements that are beyond diversity in cognitive traits that are ultimately contributing to productivity.
Well, Art, thank you so much for the call. Interesting question. Let's go next to Rodney in Santa Cruz. Welcome, Rodney.
Hello. I just wanted to bring about a point with your guest who is in Santa Clara. He's in the middle of the Silicon Valley. And I think that your assumption is that there is a cross-cultural interchange with groups. What I'm finding more so in the Valley is that we're getting large subcultures, let's say a Hindu subculture or a Mandarin subculture, or I guess even maybe South American, it's on the group, but they are on the rise. I see that cultures will not exchange as much between cross cultures, and I think it's almost like a reversal of what we were proposing as far as diversity goes. And I think you could just look at it by statistically going from company to company.
So maybe when go ahead, Rodney.
Yeah, so I think there could be a reversal there if there is not cross-cultural sharing. And I would like for your guest from Santa Clara, if he has noticed things like this since he's in the middle of the Valley.
Well, I think there is cross-cultural sharing in the workplace, and I think you've hit on an issue which has bedeviled social thinkers and policymakers certainly over the recent decades. I mean, issues such as whether colleges should encourage separate theme houses for people of different races or culture or whatever. And the tendency of people who have similar cultural or genetic origins to associate with each other, which again produces cohesiveness within the group, but not necessarily between. But I think it's a complex picture in which you're seeing certain realms of social interaction in which people are sharing and are interacting and are integrating, and then other spheres in which that may be less so. And policy certainly has gone back and forth in terms of the merits of trying to, trying to push forced quote Americanization unquote of immigrant groups, and one can certainly point to real downsides of either direction that you go on that.
Since we are very near to the end of our hour, I kind of want to actually move to that question. We've got about 3 minutes left here, and move to that question of what the understandings that we're getting from economic history and economic analysis about the effect that diverse society and diverse workforces have on growth and on dynamism and innovation. What would be, I know that drawing recommendations from these things is a little difficult from looking back, but are there any kind of threads that say you had a little bit of time with someone like a President Obama to say, hey, here's our understanding about how diversity impacts the economy and what you might want to consider as you think about that? Let's start with you, Professor Galore.
So as I said earlier, I mean, given the fact that diversity is associated with trade-offs, diversity affects cohesion on the one hand, and on the other hand, it contributes to innovations and productivity, I would emphasize policies that will ultimately mitigate the costs associated with diversity and at the same time enhance the a positive effect of diversity and innovation.
Give an example of what that means,
yes.
Minimizing the costs of diversity, what
right.
would that mean?
So minimizing the cost of diversity is associated with an education system that will reinforce what exists at the present in the U.S., namely will assure that we share a common language, that we share a common history, that we share common cultural norms, and we operate accordingly. We tolerate one another, we respect one another, and we see the virtue of pluralism in society. And in terms of the positive effect of diversity, I would try to assure that, in fact, we live in a society in which equality of opportunities is present, so as to assure that we have the most efficient allocation of talents across occupations, regardless of age, race, sex, etc. And this will assure, ultimately, that we have the optimal level of diversity and the optimal allocation of talents across occupations to the benefit of the society's productivity.
Professor Field, a last thought from you?
Well, I basically agree with much of what Professor Galore has just said. I think the role of the education system goes beyond, particularly primary and secondary, goes beyond simply teaching people job-related skills or other things of that nature. There is an aspect of socialization, and my dissertation research actually dealt with the role of Horace Mann and the Common School Revival, which tried to kind of deal with the rise of private schools in Massachusetts in the 19th century as a means of dealing with immigrant populations, and again trying to have some shared cultural experiences which will mitigate the potential for conflict in the workplace and elsewhere.
Well, Professor Field, thank you so much for bringing your expertise to this conversation. Alexander Field is the professor of economics at Santa Clara University, and he's the author of A Great Leap Forward, about how the Great Depression set the stage for a post-war World War II boom in the U.S. Also joining us in this hour has been Oded Galore. He is a professor of economics at Brown University and author of the book Unified Growth Theory. Thank you for listening and for your emails and phone calls. Rose returns tomorrow. I'm Matt Martin. What insights do homeless people have about the changing economy of Northern California? There's often a disconnect between people on the street and the people who walk past them. So as the wealth gap widens, we'll hear from people living on the margins about what they're seeing. Has the tech boom significantly affected the lives of homeless people? Is it easier or more difficult now to access basic services? And what questions do you have about what it's like to be homeless today? Join the conversation on the Next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.